This is the Rufus Project. It's free. It's like three podcasts for the price of one. Even though all three would still be free, never mind. You know what? We love bringing you this podcast for free, and we can keep doing that if it's just a little bit of extra help from you as well. How can you help? So glad you asked. First up, find the Rufus Project on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube, on Ustream. Head to our homepage, therufusproject.podomatic.com, and share us on social media. The more people that find out, the more people that listen, the more follows we get, the more we can give you guys. Oh yeah. Don't want to share the entire thing? Maybe if we bring out something that you like or one of our competitions you think would appeal to others. Share us around for that reason. If you don't want to share and would like to give us something a little bit more substantial, if you head to that homepage, therufusproject.podomatic.com, you can hit the donate button and throw a few dollars our way. Want something material for your dollars? We've got you covered there too. We have a Spreadshirt store, therufusproject.spreadshirt.com.au. Here you can find a fine selection of men's, women's and kids' shirts with a grand total of one design, but you can pick your colour. We've also got the recent addition of the Rufus Project beverage dispenser. That's right, a coffee mug with our unofficial and public domain logo prominently on the side. You know you want it, go get it. Finally, yep, I'm going to pimp myself out. If you have a product or service that you would like us to talk about in this very advertising section that I'm putting in at the very front of the podcast, let us know. You can get in touch with us by email at rufusreviews.gmail.com. We definitely would love to hear from you, and we look forward to any support you can give us. Thanks a lot. Now on with this podcast. Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project, your fortnightly guide to movie, music, games, geek news, whatever we feel like at the time. I am your host Trevor Holland, and you will be hearing from my good friend and co-host and king of cult cinema in Brisbane, Christian Fletcher, just a little bit later on. But I really got to let you know right from the top, this is a very, very condensed episode. It's a lot shorter. There's a lot of the stuff that we normally have in here that's not in here. Simple explanation: between Rocky Horror and the Cards for Sorrow floor show and me doing my debut singing solo performance at Lady Marlene's School of Arts, and with Netflix launching just the other night as well, yeah, time to record and prep and get stuff together for the podcast has been lacking. So don't worry though, it may be a shorter episode this time, but next time we'll be back with all the awesome stuff you like. And thankfully we also had pre-recorded this podcast's redeeming features in advance, so you're not missing out on that. Well, I think I'll leave the rest for a bit of a surprise for you, so in the meantime, sit back, relax, and enjoy the podcast. The geek news this time around is pretty much following the rest of the theme of this podcast. Very brief, very functional, and I'm kind of going to combine the geek news and the review section all in one. Probably the main bit of geek news that I probably will report on, and I had considered adding this to the previous podcast that came out on the 13th of March, quite an apt date for this news, but frankly, any time I tried to write about it, I was pretty much in tears, and that was a very, very sad news of the passing of Sir Terry Pratchett. He, of the Discworld series fame, one of my favourite authors who I have been reading for years, seriously. I think I first started reading Terry Pratchett back in 87. I had the privilege of meeting him on a number of occasions. I even got to perform my Igor for him from a play I did that was an adaptation of The Fifth Elephant. And even better, it was in front of a packed line and crowd at Bookworld in the centre of Brisbane. One of my favourite celebrity memories. So, Sir Terry Pratchett, thank you for all the joy. Thank you for all the wonderful, wonderful material that you have given us over the years. And I think the only fitting tribute to you would be to quote the librarian of Unseen University in Ankh-Morpork. Ook. Right, well, from that to the other, I guess, more recent big news in Australia, and that is the launch of Netflix, available officially in Australia just the other day, just Tuesday, just gone, if you're listening to this fresh. And, yes, I have attacked it, I've looked at it. If you were following the Rufus Project on Twitter or Facebook on the day, I was doing updates, checking out what was available. I wasn't able to watch too much, but I was pretty confident that the actual experience of using Netflix wouldn't have changed a lot if you were already experienced with the US version. Quick upshot is, I do believe Netflix, as when looking at the actual library, has more content in it than either Stan or Presto. Won't even bother mentioning QuickFlix because they're pretty much no longer a concern. But if you're looking at having Australian content, Stan does trump Netflix. So there's your dilemma. What I probably would suggest, that if you are a big Australian TV fan, then having Netflix and Stan running parallel may be an option. If you're not so much concerned about having all that Australian content on demand, obviously you can use services like ABC iView, SBS On Demand. Hopefully with the launch of these streaming services, the big TV channels will pull their finger out with their on-demand catch-up streaming services, which will cover you for a lot of Australian content that's pretty fresh off the mark. So if you're happy to go down that path, my suggestion after trying Netflix, Stan, and failing to try Presto because it just didn't work, Foxtel, probably my ideal recommendation would be sign up to Australian Netflix, definitely 30-day trial. While you're in that trial period, there's a service called Unblock Us, easy to find. They offer a 7-day free trial. And what you can do quite easily with a little tweak of your settings on your router, instructions are all there on the site, you can then set yourself up so you can switch between Netflix regions. Australia is on there, New Zealand is on there, USA, Canada, UK, Switzerland, Germany, Brazil. So pretty much for the cost of your Netflix subscription, plus the $5 Canadian per month charging for Unblock Us, which is still cheaper than running both Netflix and Stan at the same time, you have the entire world library of Netflix available to you at any time you like. Of course, that doesn't apply if you're out and on the go, but frankly, if you try to use any video streaming service on Australian mobile data plans, you're gonna run out of data pretty fast and end up with a big bill. So that's something I would not be recommending you do anytime soon. Of course, the other big obvious advantage Netflix has over Stan and Presto is that all its apps are available on pretty much everything you can possibly connect to the internet, and all work well. They're all well developed. They tie in well through, say, PlayStations or Xbox or through your phone via Chromecast. It's all there. It's all tested. It all works. And you don't have to worry about not having a compatible device. Stan and Presto. Pull your fingers out with Androids, will ya? Sorry, just a little pet peeve of mine. So yeah, I guess that's the geek news and the geek review all rolled into one for you. Okay, enjoy. Well, those who have been listening may have noticed that the redeeming features has been going through, I suppose, a bit of a transformation as we try to rein this sucker in. I mean, there's no doubt, if you've listened to some of the ones that Christian and I have done over the past year, that we can really, really talk for extended periods of time about all sorts of crap in these movies. So we've evolved a little bit further. I will say straight up that there will be spoilers. There's no doubt about that. And we have a plan to try to keep this under control, but again, no guarantees. So, without any further ado, since Christian suggested this podcast's interesting redeeming features movie, I might just hand over to you, Christian. First of all, how are you going, and what do you have in store for the listeners?
I am great, thank you, Trevor, and I'm really excited to be talking about a movie that I have seen a few times before that I'd always kind of, to be honest, I've always wanted to sit down with someone and kind of talk about it, like, you know, in this sort of in this sort of way. But look, we're going back to 1978 with a film that, you know, we've got the famous film star Mae West, who was, you know, an icon in the 40s and 50s. And let's just say by 1978, you just need to do the math, let's just say. And in 1978 saw the release of her last film, Sextet, which, you know, is an interesting film. I must admit, whilst watching it again, I did revisit it again for the redeeming features. But I did think to myself, is this really something that needs to be redeemed? Is it that kind of film? But I just need to compare it with what people have told me in the past and sort of the reviews I've read where people have gone, oh, my God, it's a camp catastrophe. It's a disaster. Whereas to me, I see it as a camp, fun little, I suppose, late 70s film. So it's really interesting, Trevor, to say, you know, is this film irredeemable? Is it a film that doesn't even need to be, mentioned in that way? So let's discuss Sextet from 1978. But first, let me launch into a bit of a background. The plot pretty much follows Marlo Manners, which is the character played by Mae West. Now, she's been married, I believe she's onto her sixth husband, or she's been married to six previously. Trevor will help clarify that a little bit later. Now, whilst on her honeymoon, her manager insists on her working on a new film, and she starts to record her memoirs on a pink cassette tape. Now, I tend to see this film as having many subplots, and many subplots that work and tie in together actually quite well. But I see the whole movie ideally being the hunt to get back this tape that has her memoirs on it that ends up in some quite unusual situations over the course of the movie. So that you know, sums up Sextet from 1978 plot-wise. So Trevor, thoughts and comments?
Well, we'll start off. I mean, as you listeners may realise, this is about finding redeeming features of not greatly considered or just straight out bad movies. So I thought to start off with, we'd have a look at what others think of it as a starting point. So it's rated a grand total of 3.1 on IMDb. But to put that in perspective, that's actually probably the second highest rated movie we've looked at this year so far. I think Two of a Kind actually topped 4, but everything else has been sub 3. So there you go. Already, I guess, compared to what we've already looked at, it's on a slightly higher level. But to start with somebody else's opinion, I found a wonderful review on that great review source, Amazon, by one Paul DeLint. And what he says about this movie, terrific cast, terrible movie. Where to begin? I'm a big fan of Mae West, and I was really looking forward to this movie. As far as I was concerned, I couldn't miss. A musical with Timothy Dalton singing, Mae West as a spy, okay, got that wrong, but whatever, Ringo Starr and Alice Cooper. What could go wrong? Everything went wrong. I was embarrassed for the actors. This movie goes beyond camp. Very disappointing. I purchased this movie while I was working in the Middle East, and as far as I know, it's still in some landfill over there. I gave it 1 star because there isn't a lower rating. Mae West once said she didn't want Maya Breckenridge to be her last film. Much better than this drivel. Harsh words.
Ooh, definitely. You know, but whilst on the subject of Maya Breckenridge, which was released in 1970, oh gosh, Sextet looks like, you know, the Citizen Kane of film. So I can understand that Mae would have preferred of Sextet to be her last film. But interestingly, if you were to pair the two films together, her appearances in both are very similar. She's playing this almost sort of disco diva in a way, sort of all the, doing the sort of spoken word singing over the top of these sort of iconic songs. She does that in Maya Breckenridge in two scenes. And I can understand why she would want to erase the memory of that film. But by ending this, you know, fantastic career with Sextet, ooh.
Yeah. I mean, look, her career, I mean, just from her movie side, because I know she's done stuff other than the movies, but she started in something like 1932. So we're looking at close on 50 years here. And I suppose to get the ball rolling, watching her in this movie, the act, if you think of Mae West and her iconic performances back in the old black and white days, in those Western playing the sassy, sexy, innuendo-flinging, sultry seductress, Mae worked fine in those previous movies, but she's got the same act, and she's doing that same act with the same one-liners in this movie, Sextet, in 1978.
That's just
the beginning of the awkwardness that is within this movie.
Look, it was, you know, there's been many rumors. Many people say she was, I suppose a Google search would probably prove me, give me the answer, but it was believed she was either 88 or some even say 92 when this film was actually made. So you get the feeling, Trevor, as you were saying, by saying all these, you know, what I've written down here is double entendre witty one-liners, which her whole career pretty much was banked on. It's almost like robotic-like. She's just going through the motions of just repeating these catchphrases, which made her such a star in the 30s, almost like she really didn't know any different. There are a couple of urban legends that have come out of the film, actually a few of them, but the two main ones I think of was co-star Tony Curtis said that a lot of her lines were actually fed to her through a headpiece that she was wearing in her ear because she was just not remembering them. Others say that underneath her dresses, she had actually had a cane that she was leaning on to keep her from falling over. Now, I don't know if these are urban legends or if they are actual fact, but these are statements that have come from people that were actually involved in the making of the film. So, yeah, Trevor, I get the feeling that they've almost got this, they've almost got the 30s icon and just fast-forwarded almost 40 years and with some interesting results. Sorry, almost 50 years.
Yep. And, I mean, I will come back to Mae West, I guess, a bit later because I suppose we could almost do an entire segment of this just on her in this movie. But, I mean, not only, like, does she have these lines that just... They're actually awkward in some places and clash which is going on in the rest of the movie, but it also contains wonderful dialogue, like quite early in the piece her character is being introduced and the reporter's going, "The world famous superstar, famous the world over." Really? Is that witty? That's just, when I saw that, I kind of really got an idea of, okay, I need to make sure that I set my expectations extra low for what's coming, because that's very early in the piece, even before you get to see Mae West in action, and that action is definitely in inverted commas.
Oh, God, well, I believe, Trevor, even earlier than that, from the Marlowe opening theme song, I think that's the name of the song, Marlowe, where they're like, Marlowe. Yeah, you haven't even seen Mae West, and you get straight away, you know you're in for a movie that I call fluff, you know, in a good way. you know you're not into something that should be taken too seriously.
Well, I know fluff is also another word for a particular bodily gas extrusion, so...
You'd prefer to put it with that, I'm sure.
No, and even better, sorry, I'm probably... While we're talking about the start of the movie, when the title comes up, because the title is Sextet, and when the title comes up, it's in, like, running writing, and there's a short but very noticeable pause after the S-E-X part of that title.
God. I actually didn't notice it, so maybe I wasn't paying enough attention. But gosh, but isn't it interesting? And you wonder how much actually Mae West actually had a say in all of this. It seems like she didn't really have a clue what was going on around her. It was almost like, okay, we're going to make a movie. You just stand there and stand there. I have read that apparently it is based on a play of hers from, I believe, the 50s or 60s called Sextet, I think. So I don't know if she's used a lot of the plot from that and translated into the screenplay, or I don't know if it's also seeming kind of a touch autobiographical. I don't know about her previous marriages, but it seemed it was sort of touching on being a bit like that. But for some reason, I don't know if all those little subplots involving, the cassette tape and a couple of other little things, or her husband being potentially gay, we'll touch on that. I don't know if all these subplots actually existed in the play, but somehow Trevor, even though amongst the fluff, bodily function or otherwise, it still managed to kind of all tie in and work well in spite of itself. I don't know.
I don't know how a lot of it ended up tying together. Look, there's just no way of avoiding jumping around. So there is this tape where Mae West is recording her memoirs, which mainly is just her talking about her previous husbands in different ways. And it established quite early on that it appears that it's only her and her manager, played by Dom DeLuise, who is aware of this tape's existence. And of course, it contains all this inflammatory, highly potentially controversial, career-ruining stuff. And, of course, it ends up going for a tour around this hotel they're in, ending up in all sorts of ridiculous situations. However, later on, her latest husband, played by Timothy Dalton, seems to be fully aware of the tape and its significance, and then uses said tape in order to get a summit of world leaders who are meeting in the same hotel to actually stop fighting with each other, because it seems like half the people that are in this summit are people that she talks about on this tape. And it's just like, hang on, he knows about the tape and he knows what's on the tape. How the hell does he know what's on the goddamn tape that only this woman who has been hiding it and her manager know exists? Oh. How does that fit together, Christian? How? Oh. Tell me!
Okay, maybe that part didn't quite tie in. But it was just ridiculous that recording all this stuff. And it was just, look, I think the biggest thing that, recalled when you were just saying that then was, all of this would have possibly worked as her being somewhat of a floozy. That's probably an understatement based on all these men she's apparently slept with, pretty much all the world leaders. It would have made sense possibly of a woman of a certain age, but fast forwarding again, as we've said, to a woman of possibly 88 or 92 years old, it kind of adds this level of creepy that it just never really recovers from. And so, yeah, I can understand possibly the plot doesn't really work in that respect. But I know we spoke earlier on about, the early parts of the movie with the opening credits and things. I don't know if it was just me or it might have been just my particular copy of the Blu-ray, of the DVD. Shock, God, no, mine says on DVD for the first time. That was only a couple of years ago, so I doubt there's a Blu-ray. I segue. I did notice straight away there was this notable haze over the lens, and I don't know. They do it a lot in films when they have an older actor playing against a lot of younger people, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's, that technique was employed quite a lot in Sextet, because it seems to be shock horror, the scenes with Mae West.
A little bit of a soft focus creeping in there. Is that what you're telling us?
Yes, I think that's what you'd call it. But I think, we've spoken about her acting. I suppose, as we said, we could talk all night about Mae West. But I know from, I don't know my facts, entirely right. But, I know William Shatner and a few other sort of people that weren't known as being singers released sort of disco albums in the late 70s, which a lot of them had them sort of doing spoken word over like a disco beat and things like that. And I do believe, I don't know exactly what tracks were on it, but I do, actually, I think it was Light My Fire. Mae West recorded an LP of disco tracks in the late 70s. And one of them, yeah, was Light My Fire. And it is usually, you know, very much in the voice that we're probably accustomed to from Sextet, Trevor, you know, the whole, come on, baby, light my fire. There's, you know, pretty much only one tone to it. So yeah. I get the feeling that it kind of, this was almost like a co-promotional exercise for her as well, for that disco career, because anytime there was a production number, aside from the sort of old Hollywood style numbers which sort of open and close it, it was very much her speaking over this disco beat, and it just came across quite awkward.
And we are going to talk mainly about Mae West in this, aren't we? It's not going to be avoidable. Because, yeah.
I have other notes.
Yeah, so do I, but it keeps coming back to her. Like you said, in a younger actress, some of this could possibly fly. I mean, the implication is they end up needing this tape to prove that she's divorced from one of the previous hubbies who she thought was dead. And you can tell the implication is that she's meant to not remember if she's divorced from this guy simply because she's been with so many men and is such a flighty, flirty, sexy character. Unfortunately, given just how awkward and the performance is, it does come across as senile, and I just felt like thinking, why are they letting her do this? Oh, it just seems such a shame. And in the musical numbers, most of the musical numbers are her basically standing awkwardly saying these one-liners while everybody else works their absolute butts off around her. You've got like 3 dozen dancing porters and flashy things happening all over the place with this elegantly dressed old lady in the middle. But then they do go on, and there are some full-on Mae West numbers where she's singing again in big inverted commas. And you can actually tell there's a difference to the sound quality because they've obviously dubbed over songs that she has previously recorded, obviously in much better times, when she was still in her prime. And it just has this, it just really gives us this jarring feel in these ones, especially the one where she's wishing one of the athletics team, the American athletic team, turns up, wishing him this happy 21st birthday, and it's a rendition of a song she did back in the day, which was a take on Happy Birthday, Sweet 16, except it was aimed at like a 21-year-old dude.
Oh, God. And some of the lyric changes were interesting.
To say the least.
Yes,
let's talk about somebody else other than Mae West. Let's talk about Timothy Dalton, because frankly, if anything helps save this, it's definitely the supporting actors.
Now, was his I don't have the information handy, but was Timothy Dalton fresh off playing Bond, or had yet to play it at this stage? Because I was wondering, why was he the hot property at that time?
I'm pretty sure it would have been before Bond. I'm pretty sure he was Bond towards the end of the 80s. Sorry, I'm just professionally looking up the internet. Man looking at the internet is always a good way to spend a podcast. So
it always sounds so good.
But if you look at what it did before Sextet, he was in a lot of British historical dramas, let's put it that way, in the lead up to this. So I'm guessing he would have been known as, you know, one of the most British of British actors at the time. It looks like very much that very serious, sensible British historical drama appeared to be his staple up until this point.
And it's interesting because I seem that it seems like he's sort of they he may have been cast because he, played that part. So, that typical sort of, stiff British man, because, he comes across very much as a, I suppose, as a caricature or I suppose a stereotype in the film.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, when he drops the dry British super proper innuendos, because innuendos galore in this movie, of course, it works. It does work so much better. He actually, in this movie, he's basically the straight man, in this very much vaudeville style movie, and he plays it with aplomb. I mean, considering what he's doing, the implication that he is gay, and just his comments about his days back in college and all these Americans completely misunderstanding the terms he's using, and so it sounds like he's being involved in massive male flesh orgies in his prime when he's actually talking about being on the rowing team. And he does it all just straight-faced and calm and professionally. To me, that really helped him be one of the more standouts in this movie and one of the more enjoyable actors to watch.
Well, you've led us perfectly into, what an all-star cast this film has. You just need to, like, I've got the DVD box in front of me, and they can barely fit the stars slash cameos on the box, because it's really Mae West and an ensemble of men from all walks of life, not necessarily known as being actors too, which is quite interesting. And there were some very over the top scene stealing performances, which I can kind of understand being the fact that Mae West was very much just sort of standing there like, I've no idea where I am. They almost needed to throw this extra energy in it to keep this movie going. So I believe, yeah, Timothy Dalton and his ensemble of men, not the rowing team men, actually ended up pretty much carrying this film, or kind of saving a ship that may have already been sinking when it was started to be filmed. So, one of my biggest notes here is, Keith Moon, oh my God, his over the top performance. His characterizations are like that anyway. I know him from the Who movie, Tommy from 1975. So he would have been riding that kind of fresh wave of being this real eccentric character in these movies. So I felt that he was just continuing what he played in Tommy when he performed in Sextet, just one of the many zany performances that were brought in by rock stars.
And he's not the only rock star. I mean, Ringo Starr makes an appearance, but let's face it, Ringo Starr, he's really not the best actor, full stop. It's kind of like going, hey, there's Ringo Starr. He's being Ringo Starr. Okay.
He's being a Beatle.
I mean, you talk about the supporting cast, and I mentioned him earlier. The other standout, well, basically, there is so much enthusiasm. Some of it works, some of it, like pretty much that entire World Leaders Summit, every time it appeared, it annoyed the you know what out of me. It was just repeated gags followed by fighting.
Well, harking back to Myra Breckinridge from 1970, that actually features a lot of scenes similar. So I was seeing a lot of things too, and yeah, they do come off quite boring. So sorry to interrupt, Trevor. Continue.
But if you're looking at I suppose, the supporting cast and who stands out, I was also very pleasantly surprised, I should say, by Dom DeLuise. I mean, I haven't seen anything that he's been in for quite some time. And again, I found that, like, his enthusiasm and the way he got into the role, and he even got to have his own solo number that basically implied that he had an unrequited love for Marlowe. And that song, I mean, in a movie that I really had trouble sitting through, it was like a genuine moment of charmingness in the middle of this kind of thing. Probably because it was just him, in this room. There was no massive backing dance troupe to try to distract you from the fact that there's this old lady having trouble standing up in the middle of the room. And he really like I said, he really carried that moment. I mean, from anything, it really, for me, probably was the highlight of the entire movie.
It was a really, you know, like I had seen the film a couple of times before, but, you know, had forgotten about that scene. But when it did come, when I watched it recently, I thought to myself, wow, this is a really welcomed addition. You know, it's something you kind of go, kind of elevated it to where the movie always was trying to get to, which was a movie musical, which it never really quite became. And that scene kind of reinforced that feeling of, you know, this could have been something so much better. So I do agree very much, Trevor. You know, big contrast, you know, with Dom DeLuise is to Alice Cooper, who comes in just before the end to give us one last kind of kick with a production number. And it kind of, again, harps back to one of the numbers you mentioned earlier with all the hotel staff suddenly bursting in and singing the backing vocals and putting down towels on the bed and marching out, you know, whilst you've got this, you know, 88-year-old woman, you know, leaning on the piano trying to be kept from falling over. So, you know, you really had these extremes. And, yeah, I much prefer, you know, Against the Flurry of Alice Cooper. And, I must admit, it was interesting seeing him in a different type of role, but I much would have preferred Dom DeLuise's performance any time. It was, you know, it was too try-hard, too frantic.
And, I mean, oh God,
back to Mae West.
Sorry, back to Mae West. When there wasn't a scene where there was a massive musical number in the background, I don't know if they were trying to make it seem like her slow walking was because it was a deliberate, sultry, sexual walk, but pretty much any time she moved from one room to another in this painfully slow manner, there was just this over-the-top, raunchy music that they just inserted as her travelling music.
Oh, yeah. And interestingly, yeah, you do wonder, was this screenplay actually written in 1960-whatever to be performed back then? It would have made sense, but yes, again, being performed by a woman of this age, it just really felt weird. You didn't want to hear this, ba-bum, ba-bum. It's not something you kind of wanted to associate with her in this film, let's just say. So, yeah, it was quite weird. So, but now, I know we do need to speak about redeeming features, but it was interesting, you know, as I mentioned earlier, by sort of suggesting this film, it was kind of one of those ones that was kind of teetering on the line. Like, I have screened the film. I actually did a 1978 double feature with Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, interestingly, and surprisingly the two movies work because, you know, they are camptastrophes. But it was interesting to see people's responses. A lot of people had their jaw to the ground, whereas a lot of people were enjoying it and saying, what's the issue? And then you had all the Mae West fans in the back going, oh, the poor dear, isn't she lovely? Every time she did something. So that was an interesting way to look at it, you know, and it has been acknowledged in history as sort of, I suppose, I even hate saying the word bad film because, I don't consider it that. But, you know, I don't have the quote handy, but a lot of things I have read over the years have led back to this quote, which is, really, is this a good/bad movie in its own right, or is it really possibly Hollywood paying tribute to a star in possibly the greatest way it ever can? You know, can you think of a better way to pay tribute to an actress than by giving her her own movie where it's almost paying tribute to her in a way, but obviously it's coming across very self-indulgent at the same time too. So it's kind of hard to look at it, you know, in that respect. So is it a good bad movie, or is it really just a chance for Mae West to have gone, right, I'm just going to, as you said earlier, Trevor, replace all memory of Myra Breckinridge and just adapt my play?
Well, I guess it's time to talk about redeeming features then. Mm-hmm. I mean, you suggested it, so I'm going to go first.
And, fair enough.
Look, I mean, it does have its moments, but that's really all they are, moments. As a whole, if this was meant to be a tribute to Mae West and, I suppose, the work in her prime, I just really think it really just shows that what she did didn't carry forward, particularly if you're going to try to get it done by 80-plus-year-old Mae West. Just her acting, singing, and walking around, it just seems so uncomfortable. And I've got to say it, the gags and the one-liners, old and worn out, just like Mae West in this movie. I mean, I did enjoy seeing Dom DeLuise in action. Timothy Dalton did give a surprisingly strong performance, but at the end of the day, I really can't consider this in any way a good movie. So, despite having some highlights, I'm sorry, I can't find this movie redeemable. This is not a redeemable movie.
This is really interesting, Trevor. I actually thought you would find a redeemable sort of, you'd say it was redeemable. So that's really interesting to be able to hear a different point of view because, you know, whilst very much I do understand too, I can see all its glaring plot holes and it's obviously its performance by Mae West, which really, oh my God, can't keep the movie standing up, and obviously seems she can't stand up either. But I think, you know, looking at it for its context, and I always bring us back to the context, think about it in 1978 in the context in which it was released, and, you know, possibly her wanting to, you know, replace Moira Breckinridge as her last film. You know, it's fun fluff. I'd rank it alongside something like Can't Stop the Music or Xanadu, and I know we don't necessarily speak of them in high sort of terms, but I sort of rank them along them as kind of guilty pleasure type movies, but I know I probably preferred those two movies in particular more than you did, Trevor, but I sort of rank along that. It's harmless fun, it was lightweight. I do admit there was times when I did look at my clock and go, oh yeah, I wonder how much long this movie's got to go, but it wasn't a dragging movie. It was very much of its time, and I think if you look at it as a 70s camp classic made at the height of disco, you've pretty much, you know, you've got kind of something to watch instead of Saturday Night Fever, but don't think of it like that. but going back to Dom DeLuise, I definitely believe, you know, many ticks next to his name for appearing in the movie, because he just seems to add this extra level to it. He reminded me a lot of the character he played in Mel Brooks's Blazing Saddles from 1974. So he was very much continuing that sort of character that he'd formed in the 70s. So yeah, I definitely think he had an absolute ball, you know, and it's very much tongue in cheek. He knew, oh, this probably isn't that good. Let's just have a bit of fun with it. And I think, you know, redeeming-wise, I think the cameos are what makes it. You just can't wait to see who's going to be out next. You know, oh, Alice Cooper's in this. Who's he going to play? You know, all that sort of thing. So I think it keeps it kind of exciting. So in that respect, I think it's harmless, fun fluff. And, yeah, I think it's redeemable because I think it's actually, as much as what we've said about it, it's an important movie. It's the last film of an icon, and I think more people need to see it, at least to, I don't know, put it in context. So I do think it's redeemable. Whilst it doesn't have that many redeeming features, I enjoy it, and I think it's, you know, it's no different from Can't Stop the Music or Xanadu easily.
Fair enough. Well, you know what? I'm going to say that compared to this, Xanadu was good.
Oh, interesting.
Ooh, compared to this. Oh, yes. This.
Oh, ooh, that's interesting.
Controversial. Our first disagreement of the year.
Ooh. Oh, no. This could launch a whole new podcast.
Well, look, like I said, I've been saying that we do want to hear other opinions. So I thought, like the last few redeeming features we've done, we started with a 5-star review of particular movies. So I thought, what we do, well, probably best to save that till the redeeming features section of the redeeming features section. That made sense. And so that's what I've got. So you've heard my opinion. You've heard Christian's opinion. Let's have a listen to Timothy P. Moulton's opinion. So, wild, hilarious jaw-dropper. Wow, what a movie. Mae West is great and hilarious in this pseudo-musical. Timothy Dalton of James Bond fame, Ringo Starr, Dom DeLuise, Walter Pidgeon, Regis Philbin, and many others appear in it too. West is a Marlowe Manners. Well, not quite. Legendary Hollywood sex queen. Many famous songs get a dubious revival in this unbelievable film. You will just have to see it to believe it. I guess I can't actually agree with that last line. I had to see it to believe how unbelievably bad and awkward it was. Yeah.
It's one of those movies that almost needs to be seen to make people realise that, yes, movies like this can actually exist.
whether they need to be revisited, though, that's another matter. So, but we've already established that Christian and I definitely don't see eye to eye on this one. But we want to know what you think. If you have experienced Mae West's final performance, I guess, is in Sextet, let us know your thoughts. Of course, all those details I will list at the end of the podcast. But let's move on from that, Christian, and shall I mention what we're going to be looking at next?
Oh, yes, please let us hear it.
Yep, so I had decided to challenge myself a bit this year and actually go for movies that I have never had any intention to watch. I do have one particular one on my list for further down the track, and you know what? I think I need to warm up for it first. So I've pretty much picked this next movie with that in mind. We are going a lot more recent. We're going from 1978 to 2012 with the movie that I believe may have meant to have been the star vehicle that would drive a certain actress from her previous persona to a more mature character. And what we're talking about there is we're talking about the Miley Cyrus Demi Moore movie LOL. Rated 4.2 on IMDb, so it's already apparently considered better than Sextet. I'm still dubious about that myself. So yeah, again, if you have seen this movie, or if you want to watch it before you hear our redeeming features about it, I make no promises that you're going to enjoy it, but it's there. It's meant to be bad. Christian, are you willing to try to see if this one's redeemable?
Oh, I never thought I'd sit through a Miley Cyrus movie, but hey, I'm willing to give it a go.
Fantastic. Well, until next time, enjoy LOL.
Thank you, Trevor, and I'm looking forward to our conversation about the movie, which might be very LOL.
Yeah, we can always hope. Thanks a lot, Christian.
Thanks very much. Speak to you next time.
Thank you so much for listening to The Rufus Project. We hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed putting it together. Now, if you have any comments, feedback, suggestions, requests, simply find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on YouTube, on Ustream, and leave a comment. You can even leave us a review on iTunes. Want to be a bit more private and personal? Then we also have an email address, rufusreviews@gmail.com. Also, if you are someone or if you have an event that you think might be suitable for our local wildlife section, and on the internet we are all local, again, get in touch with us at any of the previously mentioned avenues. Or you can head to our website, therufusproject.podomatic.com. If you want something a bit more fun, we also have a Spreadshirt store, therufusproject.spreadshirt.com.au. We have one design. We have some more on the way, I do promise you that. But yeah, you can get yourself a very unique shirt or coffee mug and help out the Rufus Project at the same time. And now the moral of this episode is quite simple. If you've never read any Terry Pratchett books, go read some Terry Pratchett books. R.I.P. Terry, miss you already. Thanks, guys, and see you next time. Thank you. now that I've got the singing bug after my appearance at Lady Marlene's School of Arts on the weekend just gone, I'm thinking about trying to lay down some vocals over the crackly 78 RPM vinyl rips that we use for the interspersed music within the Rufus Project. Anyone keen on hearing that? This is your chance to stop me, guys, because honestly, it probably is going to happen.